Is everybody in?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I'm here. Alan?
Will, why don't you talk for a second so we can see if the sound is a little better. What you were saying was real interesting. I think we were having a hard time hearing, though, and
all right.
Wanted to make sure that came through.
Okay, so how's the audio right now? Is it coming through clearly?
This might be a little choppy. Talk for just a second, maybe continue the idea of what you were saying, or
okay, I guess I'll just I was trying to build how my relationship McKenna started, which was that, you know, I turned on in 1994 at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, and what I was experiencing was altogether different from the people around me. And that when everyone tried to language what it was that they were experiencing, I couldn't have that conversation. There was no dynamic sharing of ideas because we just weren't in agreement about what was this that we are putting into ourselves, and what is it that we're experiencing, and what is it directing us? How does it change our idea of the rest of our lives now that we're here, now that it's happening? And, you know, I would go on raps about how, going to the moon was the building of the Tower of Babylon, and the atomic bomb was, you know, rupturing the universe by, you know, destroying an atom, and that was felt throughout the universe, and what are the implications of this? And people just couldn't follow, and they couldn't understand why I was so excited about these lines of thinking. And it wasn't until I don't even know how I found True Hallucinations, but it fell into my possession, which is a nice turn of phrase, and then I found Invisible Landscape. And it was his ideas about the hologrammatic nature of the brain and the fractal nature of the universe, and then how he kind of, all this was expressed in his manipulation of the I Ching that led him to the time wave. And when overlaid with historical and scientific data, it seemed to have a particular beauty because it fit. It seemed to fit a model of the universe. But it was different because it wasn't a map of space. It was a map of time. And that there was this brave new dimension to his thinking because all of a sudden he was dealing with time. And so it was from there on that I found a teacher because I was having a conversation through his writing that I wasn't able to have with people in my immediate surroundings. And this is the age before the internet, right? So you really were on a lonely island when you didn't have these technological channels of communication. So it was very important for me, and he was a very, very important voice. And so that's where my beginning relationship was.
It kind of gets into the idea, I mean, it's almost like the end of the Pink Floyd, The Wall, where you're like, you made it outside of the wall to some extent, and then you're like, huh, is anybody else out here?
Uh-huh.
And you're like, is anyone else out here? Who's out here, you know? And for a while, there's no one else out there, and you're like, oh, shit, I'm crazy. And then you're like, hey, there's someone else out here. You're like, oh, yeah, he's out here, and he's like doing the damn thing out here. Like, he's awesome and talks cool and says awesome stuff, you know? And so for, you know, I think with the comic book writer Grant Morrison, who wrote The Invisibles, that was somebody for me who I found kind of outside the wall that I was like, oh, yeah, you know, and there's this feeling, you know, it's almost like like love at first sight kind of feeling that you find the first or some of the first people who are outside the wall, and you're like, oh, shit, like, maybe there is something to this, you know? But I think that, in some ways, like, the dark side of it can be that's where the trap is, of that you're like, oh, well, there's someone else out here, and I'm out here, this must be some kind of truth, you know? And it's not to say that things don't resonate, and you shouldn't find connections, but I think the problem lies in something being taken as being true when it just resonates with you, you know, like not to discount your experience. I think probably all four of us have had a very similar kind of experience. And I think we're probably all pretty familiar with McKenna's stuff. You know, I think my problem with his work, and there was an interview I had posted a while back on the Sync Book thing. It had been taken down because it was on a the membership section of the podcast, A Cult of Personality, but there's a Kabbalist and fantastic artist named David Hyam Smith, and he was kind of summarizing why he had a problem with McKenna's work. And I think that this helped me kind of clarify what my problem was with it, was that it becomes a movie. Like, the psychedelic experience is a sensory thing. There's not like the magical, practical application of what you do in that realm to affect meaningful change within yourself or within others or within the world. You know, it was more of just kind of a primer. But it, you know, when you look at the drug culture or like tour kids, like Phish Kids or the remnants of the Grateful Dead thing, which probably did have some sort of, I think there's been enough research about the so-called Summer of Love. Like, it went from a beautiful psychedelic mind opening, free love thing, it degenerated to people shooting dope on Haight-Ashbury like pretty quickly. Like, it almost only lasted for about a summer, and then everybody's shooting dope in these apartments and getting STDs, and you know, it didn't necessarily have a lasting effect.
My mom would say that was happening the whole way through. That they just took whatever came their way, and because there was a flood of LSD, that was something that was taken, especially, and it was very pure to begin with, but very pure form. But then even in the midst of that, people were still taking whatever came their way. It's just that was the majority of it for a lot of people. But people still took heroin and speed. There's a lot of speed all the way through.
Yeah.
There was speed at Woodstock. You know, don't think because you watched a documentary and you're not seeing that side of it that wasn't happening. I mean, you know.
So here's the thing, is that when you take a substance like that, you become open. Like, that's what your ego death is that suddenly the boundary between you and the rest of the universe dissolves, and you become one with everything, and you're in this fractal, holographic rose window of spinning mandala energy, and you're one with everything, and you're like, that is the ultimate truth to some level. But you got to come back down to earth. And when you do come back down, then you're porous, you know, you're like a soaps, you're like a sponge, and then everything that comes your way, you're like open to, you know, you're not having, so there's a beauty in being one with everything. And then all the hippies are having an orgy in the apartment in Haight-Ashbury, and it's the summer of love, and you're porous, but then suddenly there's like an influx of bad shit that comes in with that, you know. And in a way, that isn't any different than the people who are totally plugged into the television, because they're totally open to whatever is being said on the news and stuff suddenly, and whatever is the hottest song on the radio, whatever the newest jingle is for the advertisement, suddenly that's inside them, and they're very porous. Whereas I think then what the Trivium type thing, and what not to misquote like what Jan and them's point is, but the idea of individuation and kind of becoming your own person and having some boundaries, and not like this collectivist kind of fantasy where everything's porous and we're all, I mean, that's what's going to happen tomorrow, right? We're all going to become one, and we're going to be like a macro organism on earth, and everything will just unfold from there, you know, which that really would be the ultimate dream of a control system.
Right.
So to me, the magical practice of like a good Kabbalah thing is that you're able to invoke an energy, but you create containment, you know, you're able to, almost as importantly, if not more, you're able to banish the energy away.
Well, yeah, the word Kabbalah literally means to receive, to be receptive. So speaking to what you say, porous, like the vulnerability that comes with the psychedelic experience, there's a vulnerability that actually comes with the meditation experience.
Absolutely.
And so you basically put yourself into a position where you're just like a sponge, and you take in whatever you yield to overcome everything. So there's no violence in you, but there's also no revolution. But that's why there's this emphasis that's made on keeping, like, you'll see, like, with Patanjali, it's like really heavy the way that they're like discriminative intellect all the way through. So you're meditating, you're completely vulnerable, and simultaneously you're discriminating what is coming through, and separating out that anything that stands out in space you don't take as final. So anything at all that you can hold or you see as emergent can't be the highest. And so anything that is in that form, which is form, is kept in perspective. You don't take it. So there's no mental idols. And you'll see the same thing with Judaism. That is, as far as I can tell, the actual meaning of not having any gods before you. It's don't allow any representation to be the Ein Sof in Kabbalistic terms, but to be the highest, you know, that from which everything is an emanation. You know, you keep that in mind through the whole process. And that's not something that was emphasized in the 60s movement or whatever. It was just peace and love, you know, and love will overcome, which is true, but it's not the final truth, you know.
Well, there's, and so this gets into something with the school shooting that happened over the past week, you know, and you have this same pattern. And I think why I sent you the article that was said the father wasn't connected to that one scandal is because through that, the implication is that these people are mind controlled and that this is all part of some larger thing. Whereas I think like the sad fact of it is that these are individual alienated kids who there was just something inside them that made them act in this way and go and kill a lot of people.
Yeah, even though Sandy Hook and Aurora are in Batman, the new Batman, you know.
Well, I saw that, and I wanted to download it on Torrent just to double-check, because just to make sure that Sandy Hook thing. I kind of have a question about whether that was actually in there or not, or was this just another thing that was kind of propagated out?
I think I remember seeing it in the theater and noticing it, because I've been paying a lot of attention. My last blog, and I haven't been blogging, but I focused really heavily on the Tzadi is not the star idea. And I've just been focusing on, you know, Tzadi, the Hebrew letter, means hook. And there's this relationship, right? Tzadi, Mem, and Nun. Nun is the fish, and then Mem is the water. But Mem is also the hanged man. And then Tzadi is the star. And so, and then the emperor was switched with the star. So you have Tzadi and you have Hay. And then Hay is the Shekhinah. And so it's really interesting that is taken as the star now. And then the hook is taken as the emperor. Well, the emperor is literally Caesar, which is like, you know, Tsar, the Tsar, you know, T-S-A-R, which is like an anagram for star, you know. And then it's interesting, too, because the word Israel, actually, etymologically, you could take it a couple different ways. It's to struggle. It's taken because Jacob was renamed Israel after his vision of the ascension with the ladder. After he wrestles with this angel, he is named Israel because he struggles with gods and men. But then it also, the part in the word, you have the etymological root of the word for Tsar, which ended up being Caesar, which is interesting that Caesar has this direct connection with Israel, only etymologically. But it gets really interesting in terms of the cards. And so I've been paying a lot of attention to that. When we watched it in the theater, I could swear I saw on that map Hook, Sandy Hook. And I was like, huh, it actually triggered something. And I also saw Aurora. But at the time, I was like, Aurora? Like, that really caught my attention. But I did notice the hook as well. I'm pretty damn sure it was actually there.
Well, I'm downloading it, so maybe if I can find that part.
They do a close-up of the map. So, and on the big screen, it's a lot easier.
I believe Strange Eye on Twitter, the other day, he sent out the time code. So if you check out,
I think that's kind of gets in. I mean, it gets into the same of like the Supertramp 9/11 cover, you know. And this is, I think, really where synchronicity, because I think on one hand, synchronicity is an art form and like a valid way of, as opposed to like taking psychedelics or something like that, where we have so much media at our fingertips, you can really go on this journey through the mediascape of connecting and finding these truths kind of reveal themselves. But on the other hand, I think there is like a observable, repeatable phenomenon that merits some kind of scientific, almost sort of study, you know?
But does anybody know, did anybody else look at the other references to Sandy Hook that might have been attributed to that inclusion in the movie? How right across from Manhattan, there's the Sandy Hook Recreation Area. And in an urban...
And don't forget that Gotham is... I mean, New York and Gotham City is the same thing.
Yeah.
They refer to New York as Gotham City. So the idea that it's... But here's... If I just... sorry, Bill, go ahead. Do your thing. But there's an important note here I want to add to that.
All the discussion about trying to make sense of the inclusion of Sandy Hook in that movie, and I'm not saying it's one way or the other, but you have to put all the information. That would bring in the trivium, right? Do your grammar before your logic, right? And so in a movie that's talking about someone occupying Manhattan and keeping everyone prisoner, if Sandy Hook, it's not a real map. It's a cobbled together map that's representing Gotham. I mean, but it's supposed to represent Manhattan. But it seems to me from reading that most people in an urban environment like Manhattan, Sandy Hook is one of the few refuges of nature where you can go out and actually walk amongst trees and have a very big, expansive area that's like a big park removed from the city. So to have Sandy Hook included on that map would trigger a response of, you know, even the one place that is a sanctuary from the city is sort of being taken over. It for those people who are closest to it, who know that it's supposedly about their area, it's sort of like pulling in the greatest parts of the area. And I just don't see anyone mentioning that as possible to its inclusion in the movie. They just want to jump to the tragedy. And I just like...
So I think... To me, what with the Time Wave Zero thing and the Batman movie are the same thing, of that everything is holographic of everything else, and I could take the phone book and I could randomly circle like the first 100 letters that I come across, and within that you would find a code of, because there's a fractal nature, and when you have enough randomness, then the fractal pattern that's in everything, you know, that we're kind of living within is going to reveal itself. So...
Right.
But you have to recognize the argument about the difference between habit and novelty, and the idea that the universe is a novelty-conserving engine, and that it wants to conserve these novel ideas and push them forward along the way. So when you have a system like the I Ching, that is an example of novelty, of pure, concrete novelty that has survived through thousands of years, whether as perceived as a fortune-telling system or an oracle or whatever it is. But for some reason, the universe has preserved that King-Wen sequence, which was the jumping point for the time wave. So this wasn't McKenna just taking some random noise from his environment. He was utilizing a very concrete form of novelty with his knowledge of mathematics and his knowledge of how to apply the permutations that he used, and then to have the force of mind to apply it to a historical system and to generate this conversation that grew out of why do we know what the time wave is. So I tend to give McKenna a little bit more credit with the kind of base material that he was using.
Well, yeah, he kind of gave us a starting off point to a degree. I mean,
I think can
I just add something? As the only New Yorker here, can I just add something? I included an image here. This is just, if you Google Sandy Hook Batman or Sandy Hook in Batman. I typed Sandy Hook in Batman. Now you're going to see a few still frames, and then you're also going to see someone has the actual map, the full map, where you see Gotham City. It just looks, instead of being the still shot with the walkie-talkies, you see a map, and then you guys see what I included here. I'll put a link to it. Maybe I'll put a link to it in the show notes or something. But basically...
Irving just came online. We can invite him on the show.
Perhaps. So what I wanted to get at here is this map shows a sort of bat-shaped island in the center being Gotham City, and then Sandy Hook being this like small triangle to the southwest of it as a separate little island.
Mm-hmm.
So if one were to look at a map of New York City, the five boroughs of New York City, you'll see that Sandy Hook, in this case, seems to be a representation of Staten Island.
Mm-hmm.
If one were to pull up a map at the same time, you'd see that the Sandy Hook on this Gotham City map is almost the same shape and location as Staten Island. Which is interesting to me because Staten Island has been really high on my sync radar for the last number of months. I believe that that Sandy Hook Recreation Center that you found, Bill, includes that whole sort of water coastline that includes Rockaways in Queens and Brooklyn and parts of Staten Island. It's that same southeast coast, let's say.
Yeah.
So that Sandy Hook would actually be in Staten Island. It looks like on this map, Sandy Hook is just a drop-in for Staten Island. Now, I was watching Staten Island, like I said, for a few months for a number of reasons, which might be too long to get into here. Basically, whereas I had seen when I was doing my New York City as five boroughs, that I was playing with it as being elements of the five points of a pyramid. My first assumption was that Manhattan would be the capstone, and then I realized that wasn't true, and all these things. And if anyone goes to my blog, I have written about Staten Island being a stand-in for Horus in this case. Basically, on 9/11, I show Manhattan Island as being Osiris's phallus. You see in the satellite photos the cloud of smoke coming out of the tip. It literally passes over the Statue of Liberty, which is Isis, and then the next thing that it would reach is Staten Island. And the Staten Island Ferry, which does that same exact route, which leaves the tip of Manhattan, the tip of Osiris's phallus, goes past the Statue of Liberty, Isis, and then it arrives in Staten Island at what's known as the St. George Ferry Terminal. I've shown that St. George, if you look at the image of St. George fighting the dragon, which now people think is either a crocodile or an alligator, if there was any historical accuracy to the story of St. George slaying the dragon, that they actually think it might have been an alligator or a crocodile, and that you can research that at your leisure. But basically, I put on my blog an image of Horus, an old engraving of Horus stabbing this crocodile, and a Renaissance painting of St. George doing the same, and it's literally exact. I mean,
you know, it's the exact same picture as Apollo, too. There's Apollo paintings of him doing the exact same thing when he slays the dragon. Yeah.
So, I mean, and you know, in all this, like, I also have in the back of my mind Peter Pan syncs. I had pointed out the other day, you know, this idea of Hook and Hook being Captain Hook. I actually watched the movie Hook last night. There's the whole Captain Hook getting swallowed by the crocodile. And Jason, I think, in his latest Mask of God post, sort of ran with that idea. So there's just all these different ways we can go with this. But I just want to say, so Staten Island has been something I've been watching. And then my brother passed along the news that they are planning to put, this was months ago, they were planning to put in Staten Island, they are building a giant Ferris wheel modeled after the London Eye. So we're going to have a duplicate of the London Eye in Staten Island. Now, I had made this whole idea that Staten Island, the only thing on Staten Island really of note, sorry to everyone who lives there, but it's basically the sort of like butthole of New York, is there's a giant lighthouse. So I had pointed that I was making this as the capstone. It's the lighthouse. We see this as resonating with the solar Horus, or perhaps, you know, Eye of Ra. And I played with all these things for a long time. And then they announced just a few months ago that they're building a giant London Eye on Staten Island. So I was like, holy shit, you know, and just this thing happens. When Hurricane Sandy came through, the area of New York that got hardest hit was Staten Island. Staten Island was fucking devastated, while a lot of areas of New York were not as hard hit. So basically, the area on this map that says Sandy Hook is a representation of Staten Island, which was the location that got hardest hit by Hurricane Sandy. It's a little complicated, and there's a whole slew of tangential things in there, but I just sort of want to point that out because, for whatever it's worth, there's the sinks go pretty deep on that.
So I think it's interesting you say that because there's a couple different stories that you're telling that are all kind of the same story. Like in what I've been researching recently, like the idea of the dragon and of someone slaying the dragon or conquering the dragon. I kind of like the idea of in alchemical stuff, they stand on top of the dragon, like they didn't kill it.
Sure.
They mastered it. And so what the dragon, it's funny when people, they try to relate myth historically and they're like, oh, it must have been an alligator or something. Like it was more just a composite creature that usually it had, a dragon breathes fire. It has scales like a fish for water. It has wings like a bird for air. And what was the other one? That it has like the body or of like a snake for earth. And that usually dragons were a composite of these.
Huh. This is huge. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. I have something to add in a minute.
And so then also the idea, and this to me in studying the apocalyptic so-called Mayan myth, because the Mayans, they had a great calendar. They're no more enlightened than there was probably a priest class who were, used plant substances, but they, what is to me important that differentiates the Mayans from the Egyptians is that the Egyptians, there's like everyone's afraid of this so-called eye at the top of the pyramid, whereas with the Mayans, the human stands on top of the pyramid. And I think that then allows for a projection of that there's a man up there instead of this entity, like they assume with Egyptian stuff, there was like an entity, like a reptilian entity.
That's what Jason says in his Sync book chapter. He says it's an eye at the top of the pyramid, as an eye that is can be you.
Right, and that's what it is. And it's funny that people in New Age stuff, they're like, oh, well, there's the Mayans and they have a pyramid and they worship a rainbow serpent god, and that's cool. But then there's like Egyptians and there's a reptilian evil god at the top of that and an eye, that is kind of the same thing. But the thing with the Mayan things is that the four quarters, the Mayan pyramids are aligned to the four cardinal directions, which were representative of the four elements. And I think that's what becomes interesting. So when you're doing artwork or stuff like that, it's coming from the unconscious mind or subconscious mind. And the whole idea with Jungian thought is that it isn't just an ocean of mush in there, that there's a structured element to that unconscious, So when you study myths across all different cultures, you begin to see how people in different places had the same structures in their things. And so the four elements or the four directions or the four winds or the four rivers in the Gardens of Eden or the dragons or these different things are all talking about this quadrated aspect of the self. And that's not to say there's not a three part of the self or a five part of the self, because there certainly is. But for argument's sake, I think that's one of the fundamental structures is this four-sided thing. So to me, when you look at this Mayan myth and the New Age thing, you have a couple different elements. One is man on top of the pyramid as the Mayan priest class. They always talk about the sun, So that would be that when you're on the top of the pyramid, the sun is light is the fifth element, and that's kind of what descends down into the pyramid and then condenses into the frequency becomes those four different elements. And that's the same thing you see on the back of the dollar bill as well. With the eye is essentially the sun, and it's above. If you were to take a bird's eye view of that pyramid, it would be the sun in the center with the four elements, at the four corners of the pyramid.
And right.
So it's interesting, too, to see or to hear you talk about that in your own synchronicities, you're finding the pyramid and this is kind of the capstone and then putting the eye on the top of it. Again, the eye is the sun or the solar self. And that's what I think, to me, on the positive side of this myth, isn't that the sun, it's not the sun itself out here in space is going to put out a solar flare. It's that there's an inner sun, like the central sun. Within our own self is something that we're reconnecting with, and there's this process of individuation happening and being able to draw that energy in from the central sun. But people then, they either have a dark view of it and project it outwards and think the sun is going to blow up the earth with the solar flare. So it's just really interesting. You see everybody's kind of telling the same story, but I swear they don't know the greater context of like how, where it comes from. And it's kind of the same story that people have always been telling, you know?
I really like what you said about the dragon being representative of the four elements, because I was considering Quetzalcoatl as the feathered serpent, being feathered, being air, and the serpent being as close to the earth as you can pretty much get. And so it carries that Hermes Trismegistus as a low, as below, so above idea with it. But then when you take the serpent, and especially in relationship to Apollo and Horus, like you were saying, you have this kind of like conquering of the elements, or at least controlling the elements of oneself and the meaning of that. And so I find it interesting that obviously Tetragrammaton, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, is actually representative of the four elements. And you can see that expressed through the tree itself, which is taken Kabbalistically to be a substratum of earthly existence, right? Earth is actually the composite of air, fire, and water in that system. And so all three of those come together to form this other thing. And to take that as a dragon feels really appropriate to me. And so I find it interesting as well that, like, Yeheshua, or Jesus, is actually Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh with a shin in the center. Which is the fang, you know, the so which is where the apparently possibly the vampire association with Dracula, which is Draco or whatever, is the dragon. It then becomes associated with Christianity because you drink the blood in order to live forever, and Jesus is like, drink of my blood and eat of my flesh, and then you have like the zombie symbolism coming out of that. But not to get too sidetracked, this idea is really interesting because Messiah from Hebrew is the same gematria as Nahash, which is serpent, right? And so you have this connection, and then Numbers 21 has Moses putting the serpent on the pole, and our first, where we get the dollar, pictured Jesus on one side of the coin on the cross, and then the serpent on the other. And so there's this relationship there. But
and that's man on the cross is, you know, it's the sun at the center of the cross, so the four seasons, which would represent the four elements too, or the spiritual nature of the Son of God being nailed to the cross is like the idea of the solar man being nailed to this world of four elements, kind of incarnating.
Sure, sure. And then Jew as Yehuda, right? So Judah, but Yehuda is actually Yud Hey Vav Dalit Hey. So instead of a shin with Tetragrammaton, you'd then have Dalit, which is the door, right? But there's this connection there. That's why Jesus is the king of the Jews, Jews being Yehuda. So it's Yeheshua and Yehuda right there. So it's very, very symbolic, obviously, all of it. That thing with the dragon feels personally too much to just like be like a mistake, you know?
And no, so, yeah. So
Can I interject something? I'm really sorry to do this, but I just want to back up one second. I want to throw something out here. I was trying to, while you guys were talking, trying to research something that I couldn't remember exactly what it was called, but I found it. If everyone can open a window and just Google or whatever preferred search, type in 15 islands for Robert Moses. 15 islands for Robert Moses, and you're going to see probably your first response is queensmuseum.org, 15 islands for Robert Moses, and this was a
is basically that what we click on.
Yeah, so okay. Click on that, and you're going to look at the Queens Museum of Art website, and it says Greg Cholet, 15 islands for Robert Moses.
Oh, I don't get that, but maybe it's because I'm looking at Bing. Okay, let me do Google.
Now, basically, what happens is there's this thing, the Queens Museum of Art has this wonderful, fucking awesome thing, which was done in 1964. It's this giant room where they built what's known as the Panorama of New York. Basically, it's a small, I mean, small, but still huge. It's a room. Like, you have to walk around this room on, like, ramps overlooking this giant diorama, basically, where they have made miniature models of every building in New York City.
Okay, where is this going?
Well, I'm getting there. So,
all right.
So basically, there's this. You can walk around New York. I love this particular thing. It's been there since the 60s. They've kept it. They've maintained it. They've updated it. Last year, or within the last year, I took Melissa to go see it because I've told her about it a number of times, and we went to go see it. And while I was there, they were doing this special twist on the exhibit where they asked artists to imagine if there were 15 imaginary things that you could add to this image of New York, what would you add? So, like, some people come up with, you know, this island of, I don't know, like, some chick had, like, some cheesy, like, here's a piece of fabric floating in the water, and here's the island of, like, pillows and dreams, you know? Someone builds, like, this giant, like, humongous tower, and it's, like, everybody in New York, here's enough housing for everybody in New York, it would be this giant tower, you know, blah, blah, blah. And for the most part, that wasn't, this whole exhibit, or addition to an exhibit I really enjoy, didn't really do much for me. But there was one that really spoke to me, and I took pictures of it. So you see that if you're looking at this page, queensmuseum.org/9204, 15 Islands for Robert Moses, you see surrounding the panorama is a series of posters, participating collaborators. Do you see where it says Aaron Gatch / Center for Tactical Magic?
Yeah, okay.
Click that. And this is the island that I took a bunch of photos of because this was right around the time I was syncing with all this stuff. And this is, it's actually right off of Coney Island. If someone's familiar with New York, you can imagine it's just south of Coney Island, very close to Staten Island. It's in that waterway. This is basically, this is your Sandy, what is it, Bill? The Sandy Hook Recreation Center?
Yeah.
This is there. This is fucking right there. And what struck me is that it looked like a hurricane. It's designed like this giant whirlpool hurricane thing. And he said this is based on this Robert Anton Wilson's Discordia. It's this whole like magical vortex thing.
With a gloss of the Sphero and yes. A pinch of H.P. Lovecraft for good measure.
So, and of course, he lays out a 10-tiered structure. I mean, just it was just fascinating. Like, to me, it was fascinating that, like, I was in a public museum seeing references to Robert Anton Wilson and Kabbalah and all this stuff as part of all these things, and yet to see it in the location where I had envisioned this vortex to already be, yeah, where I had already envisioned this strange magical vortex, now to see that when Hurricane Sandy comes through, so like, you know, at the time, this was like, I was thinking of this as Hurricane Erin, which is the hurricane that was off the coast of New York on September 11th. But now in light of all these things, as I was relaying some of this stuff, it occurs to me that this is could also very easily be Hurricane Sandy and all this sort of stuff. But basically, this is a long, drawn-out thing to get you guys to this website, which is, it's a long thing here, queensmuseum.org/exhibitions/exhibitions/miscellaneous pages at Aaron Gatch Center for Tactical Magic, blah, blah, blah. If I'll put the links here. But basically, when you guys find some free time, look this over. I think this goes right in with everything we've been talking about and my personal thing that I've been really drawn to. I know this is a very specific thing to draw everyone's attention to, but I sort of wanted to put this out there.
It's awesome. It's huge. If you look at it compared to the fucking buildings, that's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So
it's just this one picture of it?
Yeah, you might, if you look around online, you might be able to find more pictures. And I have on some memory card somewhere, I have a bunch of photos I took of the actual thing, as well as the different plaques that, you know, the artist's statement and stuff. But I think a lot of the information is here.
Okay.
And I said, if you look around for Aaron Gatch Center of Tactical Magic, you might be able to find some different images of photos people took. But this was the only thing of the 15 invented spaces. This was the only thing that really stood out to me. Just sort of fascinating thinking about it again now.
But is this a small scale model that I'm looking at, or is this fucking huge?
Well, I'm saying, so basically, in this thing, like, let's say the Empire State Building might be like 6 inches tall.
Okay. I'm looking at a model. You told me that, but I forgot. Okay.
If you're on this website, you can click the panorama. You see in that left hand tab space, there's the panorama. You'll be able to see. Hold on, mine's loading. But you should be able to see a bunch of photos of the panorama as it's existed for 40 years. But it's just fucking huge. You know, it's all to scale.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
It's really an incredible. And so, like, and then every, I don't know, 15 years or so, they bring in artists to update so that it stays, you know, accurate. The only thing that they did, just kind of, I guess it's debatable, but the Twin Towers are still there. There was some debate. People thought that it shouldn't be removed. It should stand as a something, you know. How are you going to take the Twin Towers out?
So when Batman takes the A-bomb off the shore of New York to let it go, and then basically everyone sees this enormous blast, is that, like, totally, like, symbolic of something? Does that connect to Dustin Hoffman having a connection to Albert Hoffman getting eaten by the giant crocodile that is time? Because Albert Hoffman's connection to the atomic bomb? Or am I just a total wingnut?
we went far off a left field over.
I was considering the Hook idea, because you said you watched Hook last night, and then Dustin Hoffman gets eaten by the thing. I was just contemplating that last night, the connection of Dustin Hoffman and Albert Hoffman.
There's
no connection other than a last name. But I just like the idea of, like, getting swallowed by time, because what did LSD do for most? Like, I mean, that was the thing. You were talking about Terrence McKenna and this and that, but what do psychedelics really, like, teach you about the nature of time, is that it's all perception and that it's all in the mind.
Well, when you talk about Dustin Hoffman again, if he was Hook, he had the Hook, kind of like the Tazid thing we were talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And and watching this, I couldn't help but think of Richard Arrowsmith's latest video, which is all about Quetzalcoatl and the being swallowed by the serpent. So, of course, yeah, the idea of Dustin Hoffman getting swallowed, like, I couldn't, you know, I had seen Hook many, many years ago. I couldn't believe some of the crazy sinks that were in this thing watching it last night. But that in particular, the idea that this would happen, that we would see this Hook as being a sort of meme at the moment that we're about to go into 2012, about to end the time wave, excuse me. And the idea of being swallowed by the crocodile or Quetzalcoatl being essentially the same thing.
Well, you know, the crocodile is associated with the Fool card, Harrow.
I can see
the crocodile in Crowley's deck, and there's this whole thing around that. I can't remember all of it, but in Book of Thoth, he explains it all.
Correct. He's kind of standing on a crocodile with one of his feet. And then the other thing, what Doug and I were talking about the other night, was the idea that he was making the point that this, everyone's talking about the 21st, end of the world. So, of course, the world card is the 21st card, right? So the end of the world on the 21, you would cycle back to zero. So you'd go from the end of the world, your next step would be to go back to zero. You'd be the Fool and the crocodile. So literally, the end of the world would be the birth of the crocodile and the Fool. All these sort of things play into it. He's been trying to figure out if each day of these 21 days of December sync at all with the tarot cards leading up to 21. It's been something he's been kind of tracking. what I noticed, like, just last night, there was, like, the Miss Universe contest. And it's funny, because for Crowley's version, it wouldn't be the world card, it would be the universe. So I emailed them last night saying, it looks like we got Miss Universe 2 days early. All this sort of stuff seems to play in. And this is where I would kind of like to take this talk a little bit, is to say, I'm really enjoying all this, but let me just throw out, I can't stay on this call much longer. I just actually started a new job yesterday, so
okay.
I'm going to have to go soon. But what I can't help but think about with this shooting, with the timing of all this, is personal synchronicities in artwork. Again, that's just the thing that most fascinates me. Terrence McKenna, I loved Invisible Landscape. I think it's fascinating. And I'd love to dissect that more, all these different ideas. But what occurred to me was that the very first comic I had ever worked on was a friend of mine. It was his idea, and he just did some drawings of this guy going crazy and shooting everyone in a supermarket. And because he thinks that he starts seeing demons, and it's basically like kind of like a Rosemary's Baby thing, right? His wife is giving birth to this demon child, and he goes crazy and starts shooting everyone, and this is sort of how this child is brought into the world. It was just my friend's sort of weird, fucked up idea, and he asked me, he's a visual artist, amazing visual artist, and asked me, hey, maybe you want to, you know, throw some extra ideas in here. So I sort of built this whole story around it, was that basically there was a kind of shift in perception that was taking place on a mass scale, and that everyone would perceive it differently, and people would start to, some people wouldn't handle it well. So if you started seeing synchronicity everywhere, or you started seeing weird energy beings or whatever, you might freak out. If you have a very strong religious background, you might freak out and think it's the end of the world, that it's angels and demons, like literal, that sort of stuff. This was an idea back in 1998. I'm a young kid in high school, freshman year of high school, and just playing with these ideas. No shit about Terrence McKenna or 2012 or any of this stuff. So this basic concept that I come up with is that change of perception, people handle it differently, and some people start to really freak out about it, and some people can handle it better. After I finished the Happy Creatures book, I had this idea. Somehow this story kind of popped back into my mind after 20, 30 years. You know, it was like, I guess 20 years. So it's like trying to think about, my math is terrible, 1998, so... What is that, like 15 years? Excuse me. So I, for some reason, thought about this thing. And, you know, basically Happy Creatures ends with a manipulated shift in perception. And I thought, I just had this idea that if I were to write a sequel to it, would sort of start with maybe taking some of those early ideas that I had in high school and playing with that. So I sat down and I write this outline. And as a sort of hat tip to this freshman year of high school idea, I decided that my Happy Creatures sequel would start with a guy going crazy and shooting everyone in a supermarket.
Don't do it, Alan. Don't do it.
No, I know. No, no. So listen, no.
All right.
So I write this outline for that, and then like sort of where the story would go from there. And I put the pen down. Within an hour, it was this news broke of Jared Lee Loner went into a supermarket and shot all those people, including Gabby Giffords and all that. And that just sort of hit me so hard as a personal synchronicity, but then just raising the questions of life imitating art, art imitating life. Was that, you know, a moment of, was I just tapping into what was about to happen in some magical sense? Did I make it happen? All these different, you know.
You didn't make it happen.
I know. I don't feel guilty. I don't feel I made it happen. I'm just saying, like.
Can I relate the whole thing back to what we were talking about earlier with the four elements?
Yeah, please.
So this, it was kind of eerie because I'd been the King, Warrior, Magician thing is about essentially the four elements and how these archetypes relate to the four elements. And the warrior would be fire, in that the fire is brought in to destroy things, you know? And so if you're to look at the pattern that happens overall with most of these kids who are doing these shootings, I think more so than the whole LIBOR scandal connection, which I don't think there actually was a connection, it seems like with both these troubled kids, they had fathers who were kind of representative of shadow kings, in that they worked for these elite banking institutions and kind of high finance, are kind of in some ways like shadow priest class of sorts for the father, you know? Mm-hmm. Can you guys kind of make that connection?
Sure.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah.
And somewhat absent in the home. It seems like the family was divorced to some extent. But the problem, I think, with young men, there's a biological imperative to be aggressive at early age. And aggression was in order to preserve the tribe and actually to protect the women and children from either animals that were aggressive and trying to eat and kill your family, or other tribes that were coming. So there's something built into the hardwiring that a young man, because people didn't live to be 100 years old, you know, like that was kind of when you were in your prime, was when you were like a teenager or early 20s, that there was a need for this aggressive energy in order to protect and preserve your tribe. And the problem, I think, with the way that people are being raised now, and it's always like these young white kids, and I would argue that I think young white men might be among the most aggressive animals, considering the conflicts that happen in Europe, and you even look at the world wars, there's something within the psyche of white men that is extremely aggressive. And I think probably there was limited resources and a lot of killing of each other's tribes going on in Europe. You know, it was really a hotbed for that. So now we're in America and we're all domesticated and nice, and you're told to have absolutely like no aggression whatsoever. So you're having like no fire. There's no fire in the equation, you know? And I think like what should be happening with these young kids, because supposedly this kid was saying that he had murderous tendencies or some shit and his mom was going to have him committed, is that instead of trying to totally suppress this aggressive instinct, that there needs to be like a positive outlet for it, you know, which probably in the form of martial arts. And the thing with the absent father is that these men were absent, whereas they needed like a stronger male, because a stronger, more mature male would know how to properly deal with these aggressive tendencies, you know?
So how does this tie in with the four elements, other than the fire aspect being the warrior that destroys?
Well, the thing is that when you suppress any of the elements, it then short circuits the other elements, as well as then creates like a shadow side, so that when the fire is totally suppressed, it then goes to the shadow side, where it gains a tremendous amount of that shadow energy, and instead of the power being used to protect the women and children, this kid then has a shadow warrior that explodes out. All these kids, it is the same thing. Why do they always shoot up schools, you know? They're always shooting up the weakest among the people. They're not shooting up grown men, you know, or somewhere where men are. It's the opposite. It's the reverse of this. So when they're going mentally and emotionally crazy, it's because all that fire energy is flooded into the air and water circuit, and they're just, these kids are going crazy, you know. There's not an even command. They're not at the center of the pyramid combining the four elements. They're at like the outside of the pyramid, you know, on this one particular side.
Mm-hmm.
So it was eerie listening to this Robert Moore tape, that the tape he does about the warrior was in 1989. And he's like, well, it's kind of fitting that we're talking about the warrior today, because just yesterday in Stockton, California, bear in mind in 1989, there was a shooting at a schoolyard. He's like, in this you see the shadow warrior of this energy that would have been used to protect women and children, then being ritualized in the shadow form, because this is a ritual of sorts. Like these kids, they dress up, they go in, and they act out this ritual drama ending with them killing themselves, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think that's why oftentimes people think it was mind control thing is because it's so similar. But this is like the shadow program then acting itself out.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's like displaced ritual. I mean, you mentioned like if you had an outlet like martial arts. Martial arts is very much you're trained and taught to have, you basically modulate your own ritual, and you also yield to overcome, and it teaches you how to basically channel that force in appropriate ways. And all, yeah, that, I could definitely see your argument. That makes sense.
What happens with the kid? And so that was my point too, was that both of these kids had absent kind of Shadow King fathers, because the high finance father is absent from the home. He's not being a model for the male. There was a weird thing with this last kid, that why did his mom have, you know, all these assault rifles and stuff in the house? So there was that kind of shadow aspect of it, of like a hostile mom that he was afraid of, you know?
Mm-hmm. And very strange situations, both of those shootings. So these things happen more regularly than the media focuses on it way more heavily when it happens in any kind of suburban situation or where there's money. It's like, these people come from good homes. How could this is a good Christian community. How could this happen to us? You know? And it's like, you know, like 9/11, I mean, there's terrorist shit that goes down on a global level all the time, but it does. I mean, we're like, on our soil, this is going to take place. We won't stand for it. Like, we have a different relationship to it when it hits closer to home. And so, because the media is definitely, I don't know. It seems like there's some weird side to that.
The other weird thing, so there's a couple things. One, like with the martial art things, one of the more important things would be that the kid is allowed to let his fire energy out, and he realizes that it's not that bad and also not that dangerous. Mm-hmm. Because when it's sent into the shadow and it gains all that extra energy, then the kid is thinking, oh, I must be like the great Satan, and I'm the devil and like the great destroyer sent to destroy the world, you know? Whereas mm-hmm. if he was put with a grown adult man and allowed to like punch at him and kick at him as hard as he could, he would let the fire out and realize it's not that big of a deal, you know, that he's really not bad for that and he's really not going to hurt anybody that bad. It's when these like older men are kind of absent from this mentoring or process that then allows these younger men to let out that aggression and kind of ritually contain it. Because that was the point.
In the movie Hook, the whole idea of Hook is that Peter Pan grows up, right, and he becomes a lawyer, and then he's essentially an absent father. And what happens is that Dustin Hoffman, Captain Hook, ends up trying to convince Peter Pan's son, hey, your father's never there for you. He's this big, powerful finance guy, but he's never there for you. Learn to apply your desires into becoming a pirate. And all this sort of stuff, and he actually convinces the kid to go around smashing all these. There's one scene where he's like, "Let out all your frustration," and the kid starts smashing everything, going like, "This is for never being there, not showing up my baseball game. This is for right. It's exactly yeah.
And
what
then
we're talking
they,
about."
They let you know that the child is symbolic of pretty much every man being that he's yeah. Jack, and yeah. so it's yeah. Run home, Jack. You know,
and what they do. If I may, what they do is they do this whole thing, right? So it was funny because I was talking to Melissa before we watched it about Wendy from The Shining being where he says, "Wendy, darling, light of my life." So this like this connection to The Shining being also like Peter Pan. So then I see this thing. There's this scene where the kid is throwing a baseball against a wall frustratingly, and Robin Williams is going, "Jack, Jack. Jack, listen to me, Jack." And I'm like, oh shit, it's like when Jack Torrance is throwing the fucking ball against the wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And but then like this idea of Jack is another name for Osiris. And I'm just watching as all the archetypes play out and all these
things. See, wait a minute. How is Jack another name for Osiris? Because that's how I met Steve Wilner initially, was that I watched a video of the Psychonaut or whatever, and I went and I messaged him that question, because he said that, and I was like, how?
All right, go to, I guess you'd call it like Celtic folklore. there's like the character Jack in the Green, but sometimes it's just Jack or Jack in the Green. And basically it's this, sometimes he's a vegetative man, which of course Osiris is, the grain grows out of his body, so he is the vegetation. He's also the sort of the same thing that dies and is reborn.
Green Man, Jack in the Green.
Right, gotcha. He's Green Man. And perfect. So
then he's the Fool as well. And so you have it goes around full circle.
Yeah, well, exactly. So
back to Heath Ledger.
Full circle.
Okay, so simple equation, Nun plus Mem equals Tsadi. So Nun is 50, Nun is 40, Tsadi is 90. So 50 plus 40 equals 90. Nun is obviously death, right? The fish, the Vesica Pisces, your Jesus Osiris character, right? Mem is... The hangman, which is obviously our Heath Ledger character, right?
So or have, Odin hangs from the tree upside down.
Sure. And also you have St. Peter is hung upside down, and that has a whole significance as well. But I really like the interesting, like, Nun, transformation, and death. You have death and the hanged man equals the hook, which is the fish hook, right? So it catches itself. So in this, you have a circle. Because the Nun itself, being the fish, is caught by the Tsadi, but it also equals the Tsadi.
Shit, there's a scene in Hook where the kid, it's all about the kid playing baseball, and he keeps wearing this glove on his hand. And then his grandmother says to him, "What's this glove?" And he says, "It's for catching things." So he has the glove hand, the baseball catcher's mitt is the same thing as the Captain Hook. The hook is what you catch something on.
Right. Totally.
It keeps making me think of the scene where Luke Skywalker gets his hand cut off, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the same exact idea.
And Darth Vader is obviously for, like, Dark Father. That's the meaning of this kind of technocratic, you know, he's kind of the high finance father, mm-hmm. The absent father.
He's more
Da like Invader.
The Odd Vader is how you said.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yes.
Interesting with the Peter Pan thing too, because that's kind of like the eternal young, and that's like the puer eternus, like the forever immature man. So the other element of these kids going in and killing other kids is that there's a process inside them where, because the ritualized. There was a rite of passage between youth or pubescence and adulthood for young men, and it was happening cross-culturally, and they weren't just doing it for fun. They knew there was a reason they had to kind of ritually initiate young men into adulthood. Largely part of it was because they knew that young men were dangerous, and they needed to kind of then cross them over into being a mature adult and able to defend the tribe. And you know, it would usually involve some kind of ritual process combined with some kind of psychedelic experience that was symbolic of death and then a rebirth into adulthood. And so in that death experience, they were killing their child within and then being born as like an adult man. And so there's something inherent, because that was happening for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. So there's a process built into that, but it doesn't happen anymore. And I think then you externalize it and project things that the kid trying to kill other kids or going to a school and killing other kids is trying to kill because he's always killing women and children. He's trying to kill like the young part of himself in order to become a man, thinking that power is associated with destruction.
I just realized something. Sorry. Bill, you say bowlers throw a hook. You may have found a possible subtext for the Big Lebowski and nobody fucks with the Jesus because Jesus wants to make fishers of men, and every time they bowl, they're
well. I've been dissecting Lebowski surrounding Hook, because there's the scene where they show the Nihilists' album called Autobahn. Right? And the Autobahn is a highway that stereotypically is that the only speed limit is you can't go too slow, right? You can go as fast as you want. Really, the only thing illegal would be to go too slow. And that's what the dude is. The dude he travels at the lowest speed that you need to be legal. That's his whole method, right? Well, the name of that album is called Nagelbett, which translates into Nail Matrix, right? Well, Vav is the hook, is the nail, right? And about 10 minutes later, after he holds that album, just like anything in that movie, everything that they hear resurfaces later on, he's seen nailing a board to the floor in a nail matrix. And he affixes a chair to it to block the door so that intruders can't come in. Well, obviously the door opens the other way and the chair falls down. His nail matrix didn't work. But there's this whole concept of the Vav, which I was reading in the book The Hebrew Letters by, I forget his name now, but it introduces this concept of teshuva, which is repentance. Mm-hmm. And repentance through love, it brings the future into the past. And there's this concept that if you're accurately repenting about the mistakes you've made through love, you draw the future into the past. And that's accomplished in that movie because of the whole subtext of 9/11 and Saddam Hussein, and you can go all the way into that thing. And that's what Sync is to a certain extent, is that if you're going about this whole thing accurately, you'll find that you've drawn things that happen in the future into the works that you've put out in the past. And I've been puzzled about this, and I'm not sure exactly where all this is going.
I'm not either. I found a sync that I really liked with The Big Lebowski, where he's in the bathtub, and the nihilists come in, and they got the fucking, he's like, nice marmot. It's not really a marmot, it's a ferret, right? And they throw it in the bathtub, but he's listening to whale sounds, but it's Flea. Flea walks in, he's one of the nihilists, and then Flea meets Johnny Depp as Hunter S. Thompson in the bathroom in Fear and Loathing. But I was considering that scene with the bathtub with the attorney where he's flopping around and he's on acid. And he's like, did you eat all this acid? And he wants him to play White Rabbit, right? And throw it into the tub with him to kill him, you know? He's trying to commit suicide. Uh-huh. But that I was considering that he's like, okay, so Hunter S. Thompson responds to him with, don't fuck with me now, man. I am Ahab, which is a reference to Moby Dick. So Ahab fights the whale, but then in the Big Lebowski, when he's in the tub, he's listening to whale sounds, so he's got like earplugs on, it's like songs of the whale. So it's interesting, I was considering that like the attorney is like the great white whale, which is supposed to be symbolic of the ego. It's an ego death or whatever. It's like even the highest form of, it's a complicated thing, but there has been stuff written on, I forget the name of the author, but I could look it up. This guy analyzed Moby Dick and looks at it from a spiritual perspective and shows the significance of the great white whale being, your glimpse of liberation, but then even your ideas around liberation have to go down with yourself, basically, that you have to experience an ego.
The white whale is the transcendental thing at the edge of space, too, that there's like this thing of light. And to me, that's what I think McKenna was projecting his own personal experience of this, because to me, the transcendental object always is in front of us in time. It's never, and it's always radiating back, and that's kind of like the creative source. That's, to me, the same thing as the sun or the galactic center. And that's where this creative energy radiates out through, and that's like what's manifesting the future. I don't think there's ever going to be a omega point, because as soon as you get closer, it's kind of the white rabbit too, you know, or the white whale.
Yeah, it's the carrot at the end of the stick, right?
Okay.
Because it's always pulling you forward. But even Terrence McKenna's time wave, he would have to accept that it was an asymptote. You know, you can get closer and closer to something, but you're not going to touch it. It's the perpetual carrot that you're following.
Yeah, always.
That's my problem with him, is that then he takes his own metaphor of this. Like, I think he was delusional to then project it onto the world and say, oh, well, my own journey of this is so grand and my study of this, that obviously the world's going to end then. I think it's kind of
arrogant. Well, see, that's where I disagree, is that I've listened to hundreds of hours of McKenna over and over and over. And I think that's a very thin definition of Terrence McKenna. That's just my opinion, Justin. You know, no offense taken. I just think that is not the Terrence McKenna I know, because I've heard him circle this idea in so many different ways that there's no definitive Terrence McKenna time wave explanation. That's my opinion. That's what I've heard.
Have, And even reading Invisible Landscape, he does, you know, there's a lot of question marks put on it. And
When he says that, you know, it could just be, he goes, I could just be living in a simulacrum, a Philip K. Dick kind of experience. And the only clue to this simulacrum is this thing, this time wave zero. But if this is that thing that clues me into the simulacrum, it will be the tool by which I sort of wedge myself out of that matrix of simulation. So he allows it to be a sort of a made-up thing to defeat the made-up thing. The mongoose, you know, that catches the imaginary snakes, that it's just pure magic, which ties into his whole way of explaining the world is made of language. And for me, if you really the course of Terence McKenna, you have to grasp his whole, the way he explains, the way he has assimilated the whole universe is made of language and what that means. And that just is just beyond most people. It's still beyond me. I'm still grappling with it.
So I just want to jump in really quick and just finish where I was actually going with that set of connections. So A Serious Man, if you've seen it, another Coen Brothers movie like The Big Lebowski, starts out with this whole, the cobblest shows up and he's actually dead, a serious dude. I like that.
The two movies are interrelated, but yeah, continue.
It starts out with Someone to Love, but it goes through all of Surrealistic Pillow, which has White Rabbit. The only song that I could spot that wasn't actually in the film from Surrealistic Pillow was White Rabbit. So White Rabbit's the one that's left out, which is kind of interesting. But when he finally goes at the end and meets the rabbi, he lists the names of Jefferson Airplane and then goes, these are the members of the airplane. But I like the way if you can see that the Coen brothers are obviously hip to Kabbalah to some degree, because that movie is just loaded from top to bottom with Kabbalistic symbolism and underpinnings. Well, and so, you know, and then obviously you have Terry Gilliam did Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and then here you have The Fisher King, which is completely loaded as well.
Absolutely. I think The Serious Man and Big Lebowski are two movies that represent two different ways to approaching. And that the whole notion of the teshuva by love, which draws the future into the past, is the opposite with The Serious Man, is that Larry is approaching it through fear. His repentance before God is it's all about fear. And that has an opposite result. And when you take that into consideration, there's a very complete picture going on when you merge those two characters and the journeys that they go through. It's
well, he's displaced his fear, because awe and fear are basically the same thing. To be in awe of something is to recognize your insignificance in relationship to that, what you're in awe to. That's why you're supposed to reserve your awe for the final thing that actually calls for awe. But he is in awe of everything, and that's his problem. That's why he's experiencing so much suffering. He's basically living in a world of false gods that he has built up in his mind to be greater than they actually are.
Hey, so I'm gonna have to.
Oh yeah, you gotta.
I just want to say, I don't know. There's so much shit I want to fucking say, but a weird sync is that last week's show, David. It was just last week, right? We had Vinny in the second hour. So when it was just starting off with just the two of us, we were talking about What About Bob? And I ended up watching that movie afterwards. Now, what's weird is, so we talked about What About Bob, and we talked about Moby Dick and, St. Elmo's Fire, which apparently is in Moby Dick. And basically this idea of, I make the poster for last week's Always Record I made was a ship, like an old merchant vessel, with, instead of putting a pirate flag on it, I put the shadow of from What About Bob. Now, we talked about that kid who wants to dive into the water. That kid wears all black, right? He's sort of drenched in the shadow. He's afraid of death and all this sort of stuff. He's got this whole morbid thing, and he doesn't want to die. Now, here, last night I watched fucking Hook. the same son, the little boy who plays the son in What About Bob, who doesn't want to dive, mm-hmm. is the same boy who plays Peter Pan's son, who smashes all the clocks in Hook.
Yes.
So now, that kid, I put the fucking What About Bob on this fucking sailing ship instead of a pirate logo, and now I watched a movie last night where that kid becomes a fucking pirate.
Right.
Right?
Oh, and
the whole thing is that Peter Pan is getting his shadow back from Wendy, right? She puts his shadow back.
So back on his feet.
Oh, it was just this crazy string of syncs. Now, because the reason I have to go is because I started a new job yesterday. And basically, I've been struggling with trying to, you know, put together...
What kind of job is it?
Well, it's working as a waiter again. So, it's really funny because when I did Sync Book 1, while I was working on Sync Book 1, is I was working as a waiter at a Mexican restaurant on 51st Street and 9th Avenue. And I've been thinking while I was doing Sync Book 2, I was fucking starving. I'm fucking, I have like no money for anything. But there was so much work that needed to be done for Sync Book that was just sort of consuming me. And so whatever. So I'm fucking flat out broke. And I just was like, man, if only I could have like, you know, that job wasn't bad. And I wish I could find something like that again. So check it out. I was on 51st Street and 9th Avenue, which, you know, might not just a specific address, but that's a very, very specific thing. New York's pretty fucking huge.